was relapsums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 148 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from San Francisco, California. I'm your Andrew Brokus, and with me is your Nate Mavis.
How are you?
I'm good. How are things in Somerville?
Just about perfect. Nicest fall weather I've had since moving to Boston. Just really feel like I'm owning life these days. The weather's very, very nice. I'm walking around a lot. I'm also reading Snow Crash, which is a big deal for me because I don't really like science fiction, so I'm broadening my horizons here.
I have heard of that, and I'm embarrassing myself that I can't think off the top of my head of who's the...
Neal Stephenson.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I read Cryptonomicon, or however you...
Cryptonomicon, yeah.
Yeah. It was okay, but it was really long.
Yeah, it's very long. It's interesting. It's... So the obvious thing to say is I'm impressed, like, how right he is about advanced internet culture in 1992 or whenever he's writing. Like, he gets a lot of stuff right that was not obvious. Like, there's a, I guess somebody famous once said that, like, it's easy to predict the car and hard to predict the traffic jam. And I think he's pretty good at predicting traffic jams. Some of the writing's a little bit uneven, but I think it's good. I like it. Sci-fi is really not my thing, but I'm still reading and I'm happy about it. So that's what I'm up to.
Yeah, I had a little adventure the other night. I guess this was Sunday night. Something woke me up at like 3 a.m. unrelated to what ended up happening. And I sort of wandered blearily out of my bedroom and noticed like water all over the kitchen floor. And I was like, oh, this isn't good. and the hot water heater was leaking, which fortunately I'm a renter. So, replacing the hot water heater is not my problem.
Yeah.
But the water on the floor in the short term is my problem. And yep. I didn't have an emergency number to reach the landlord. I just called his cell phone and he didn't immediately answer. So I think this is really just something that is part of being a mature adult generally, but it's something that I kind of credit poker with teaching me, is the like doing the right thing even when you don't feel like doing it, or like even when it's kind of hard to do, but just like recognizing that your decision isn't going to, there's a huge part of you that's like, I'll just deal with this in the morning, and wants to go back to bed because it's like 3 a.m. But nothing, the situation is not going to improve between now and 3 a.m. So I spent like 3 hours just kind of like getting, and there's also the indignity of like, this shouldn't even be my problem. Like the landlord should come over here and clean up this water, or, do something to stop it. So I'm like trying to figure out how to shut off the water to the hot water heater. And like, it seems like it should be fairly obvious. There's just like a valve to close, but it didn't seem to be doing anything. And it turned out that it just wasn't installed. I mean, I don't think it was a problem with the installation exactly, but like the valve actually didn't do anything. So it wasn't just me being dumb. Like, it was supposed to be a shut off valve that didn't function that way. So I was like trying to figure out how to turn it off, and then I spent like 3 hours just kind of like mopping up water, and then I went to bed for like 2 hours just to get a little bit of sleep, and then there was water all over the floor again when I woke up. And we finally got it straightened out, and but part of you was like, I spent like 3 hours in the middle of the night just kind of like mopping up water, trying to like stem the tide, and then there was still water all over the floor in the morning anyway. But you realize like how much worse it probably would have been if I hadn't done that, and maybe it would have come out of the kitchen into other areas of the apartment and ruined stuff, and whatever. I kind of felt good about doing a sort of making a difficult, uncomfortable decision that just on the rationale of like, well, you don't have good options here. because I do think that's kind of a mistake people tend to make in poker, where they tend to focus on like one thing that they don't want to see happen. They're like, well, I don't want to slow play this because what if the turn is another club, just like zeroing in on one bad option rather than looking at the pluses and minuses of the entire situation, which was sort of what I felt like I was doing in that moment. There's a part of me that was like, oh, I just want to go to sleep. It's like, well, okay, but do you want to deal with like flooding all over your apartment in the morning?
Yeah. Well done. So last week was Andrew shaming week for getting in a lot of money with Ace King for no good reason. And this week is Andrew praise week for making the right decision in the middle of the night. So
Although I will say 3 days later, or maybe it's more like 2 days later, but my wrists are still really killing me just from like wringing out all these towels and stuff. Like they really, really hurt. And it just gives me an idea because I've seen so many dealers with the support wrist, from carpal tunnel and that sort of thing. It really gives me an idea of like how miserable that must be to have like constantly sore wrists. Because I mean, it's definitely better now than it was a day or two ago, and it's continuing to get better. And pretty soon I expect to be without wrist pain. And but I'm realizing just how miserable it would be to have chronic wrist pain. So dealers, I have new sympathy for you.
All right. And you are renting, so it's a pain in the butt, but not a pain in the wallet, so that's good.
Yeah, actually, that's funny too. I went in the morning. I didn't even have a mop, so I was just like soaking stuff up with towels and then wringing them out and then putting them down again. So I went in the morning when the hardware store opened to buy a mop, and the woman in the hardware store was like sympathizing with me as though it were like, she's like, "Oh, I had a hot water heater broke too," and this, she was like kind of talking to me as though like it was going to be my problem to replace it.
Yeah.
I was like, "No, I just lost a few hours sleep. Like someone else is going to be shelling out
Yeah.
$1,500 or whatever it costs to have a plumber come in and replace this," which to his credit, he did. I mean, the rent is extremely high for what we're getting because it's San Francisco, but the landlord has been good about stuff. So I mean, he did come over right away in the morning and help to get the whole, stop the leak and get stuff cleaned up and had a plumber in. So like by 3 o'clock, I had a new hot water heater and no water on the floor.
All right, so that's the glamorous life of poker minor, poker celebrity Andrew
Oh,
Brokos.
actually, you know what else? I played with Andrew Seidman, our guest.
Oh wow, how'd that go?
Beluga whale, not well.
Did it go well for him?
It did,
Yeah, all
although
right.
not really for me. It was just like it was a bad game. Actually, I think that was earlier that night. That was Sunday, like. That was a few hours before the whole hot water incident. I don't often go to lucky chances on Sunday, but I hadn't gone on Saturday because it was I think Saturday was it was Halloween. So I had been out for Halloween, so I didn't play on Saturday night. So I figured I would go on Sunday instead. And I think a lot of people had been out late on Halloween, and so there wasn't much of a game on Sunday. We got a 5-10 started, and then it wasn't very good, and a bunch of people left. So I was just playing four-handed with someone who I didn't even immediately realize was Andrew. And then I heard him introduce himself as Andrew to somebody else, and then I was like, "Oh wait, that must be Andrew Seidman." Because he wasn't talking that much, and it's been a while since we talked to him, and I didn't ever really have that clear an idea of what he looked like. So I felt kind of bad because I didn't introduce myself immediately after I realized who he was, which probably did give me some advantage in the game. Although I don't think I'm going to be mistaken for a fish, even if he doesn't know exactly who I am.
It's an ominous. That's a really ominous scene, like you facing a bet from Andrew Seidman, poker expert, and somewhere the water heater is going to hell and your apartment's going to flood. Like the preconditions are getting in place for you to have this terrible overnight event. So it's a rough night, rough night. It's a scene from a horror movie in poker, in sort of lazy poker player world. So it's,
And we actually, to come to think of it, we're not into the strategy segment proper yet, but I should caution people. What you're getting right now, this is the episode. We don't have a guest, so Nate and I are going to maybe chat for another minute or two, and then we've got each of us has a strategy hand that we played recently. His is from a heads up play money match, although being played seriously, this was a match for pride.
Yes.
It was a grudge match even.
Yeah, against somebody who I can trust to actually play well. So it's a rare thing, play money poker that's being taken seriously. So.
And my hand actually came from a 30-60 limit hold'em game. It's quite a rarity for me, so you can stay tuned for those. But this is just a little hint. This is a hand that I played, maybe the only truly interesting hand that I played with Beluga Whale, Andrew Seidman, during the time that we were together. So the game went well for him, not really because of me. He won a lot from someone else. I didn't lose much in the game. I think maybe I lost a little bit to Andrew, but not like a big pot.
Yeah.
So there was one. I opened pocket sevens. From technically, it was a 5-10 game, but it was four-handed, so everybody was straddling just because you might as well if you're playing four-handed.
Right, sure.
So I think I opened the button. Maybe it was the cutoff. I think I opened the cutoff with pocket sevens, and he called from the straddle, and the flop was queen 6-3. So I had opened for 60, and so now we're looking at about 130 in the pot after the rake and whatnot. And the flop is queen 6-3. I have pocket sevens. He checks. I bet 60 again. He raises to 160. I call. the turn was something pretty blank, 8 maybe, mm-hmm. and it goes check, check, and the river was another very blank card, and it goes check, check again. I win with 7s, and he has A6.
Okay.
Which initially I didn't love his check raise with A6, but I think looking back on it, it's a little... I think it's, you know, like, I am going to defend with some 6x and maybe even some pocket pairs worse than that. And so, like, the fact that he dominates all of my 6x, you know, his hand benefits some for protection. On the other hand, like, having an ace in his hand, he has some incentive to not blow me off of a hand like ace-9 or something by check raising. But I may not be betting my ace-9. You know, in that spot, I probably am, but he might not expect that. Or I might not fold some of my ace-x to a check raise anyway. So I think the fact that, like, he's dominating a hand like ace-jack that I might bet call, and he's also dominating a hand like 6, you know, 7-6 or something that I might bet call, I think it's actually a reasonable check raise.
Sounds right. Sounds right. Nice answer.
Yeah.
And is there
a pleasure playing with you, Andrew, and not that I really expected he's listening to this, but sorry that I didn't introduce myself immediately. But I did before we left, and we shook hands and whatnot.
All right. So we've got a hand history with Andrew Seidman, some discussion of science fiction, discussion of plumbing, play money poker, and limit hold'em. Is there a Bluff Reader's Choice Award for a poker podcast least like other poker podcasts? Like, anyway.
All right, so without further ado, let's talk strategy.
By the way, by the time you are listening to this, you will be able to trade 5 of your dollars for one of my ebooks. So
get a penny back too, right?
Yeah, that's right, $4.99. So long discussed. Turns out editing and getting a cover and all these things takes a long time, but it's now out. You can buy it at nickcast.com. You can buy it at Amazon. The title is Thinking Tournament Poker. It is a hand-by-hand analysis of the hands I V-pipped during day one of the 2014 main event. You hear what I think about these hands. You hear what Andrew thinks about many of the hands, what Leo thinks about many of the hands, and what Gareth thinks about many of the hands. And one fun thing about the book is that my co-authors all have different styles. So I have my own narrative style, and like Leo has his own Leo jargon, Andrew has his own way of doing things, and a lot of Gareth's comments are like 7 words long but utterly devastating. So that's it's great fun. You really get the thinking poker feel, I think. And yeah, it's out. It's an annotated hand history. It's a little bit shorter than one of Andrew's ebooks, but very content dense. It was fun to write. It was a big project. If you read it, I hope you like it. If you don't read it, that's okay too. So
I think we should emphasize, you know, how much more strategically dense this is. Like my ebooks have, I mean, it's not even really 50-50 strategy versus narrative. It's maybe more like 30-70 or 40-60. And this is like really, really thick with strategy. This is pretty much just like in-depth of analysis of, and you know, let's underline this as well. This is every hand that Nate played on day one. So you're seeing even a lot of, it's like, I think the issue is like a lot of books tend to focus just on like one or two significant hands. And you know, often it's more important really to get small little fundamental spots right than it is to, your hands are more interesting to discuss sometimes when something weird happens, but realistically, like weird stuff doesn't happen that often. And making sure that you're getting fundamental little things like opening ranges and defending ranges and c-bet sizing, like getting that kind of stuff right is really far more important. I think seeing, you know, how Nate's doing that and what kind of stuff he's considering on day one of the main event, I mean, I certainly found it eye-opening. I think a lot of people will benefit from looking at it and find it entertaining as well. I mean, you're going to have a hard time spending $5 better in terms of a poker strategy investment. Let's say that.
Yeah, I'm glad you think so. My game's a lot better for having done this. It's really something how many leaks you can find if you actually go through all your hands. turns out there's a lot, and I play better now than I used to. I think if you study this book carefully, you will play better than you used to, too. And that's probably worth $5 to you. So, Nickcast.com, Amazon.com, Thinking Tournament Poker by the Thinking Poker Crew. So. We better get out of this bag before we get in trouble. And I said.
Our strategy segment today is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge, one of the best sources on the internet for tournament poker strategy, including from myself. I've got quite a few videos on Tournament Poker Edge, and my newest is a hand history from a $2,000 World Championship of Online Poker event. And because it's a Sunday tournament, you will actually see a diversity of players. So it's not only about how to play against really high-stakes, tough players, although I certainly did end up with a fair number of those at some point in the tournament. So I think there's a lot of entertainment and a lot of educational value in this particular video series, as there is in most of my videos and most of the videos on Tournament Poker Edge, which you can get access to all of those by subscribing today at tournamentpokeredge.com. So let's polish one of these. Hopefully we can get this one out of the way quickly. But I have actually a 30-60 limit hold'em hand that I played that I'd be curious to run past you. And this is probably an extremely standard spot for anyone who knows really anything about playing limit hold'em. But I happen not to fall into that category.
Sounds good. Which cambio? This is very good. This is.
Arguably, sitting down at a 30-60 table is the first ill-advised decision. But I was waiting for, the details aren't particularly important, but I was waiting for a seat in a different game, and my options were I could either play nothing, I could play 1-2 no limit, or I could play 30-60 limit, and I knew I wasn't going to play for probably only 20 or 30 minutes. So, how big of an edge can I be giving up playing for 20 to 30 minutes? Or, in absolute dollar terms, how much could it be costing me? And I figured it would be interesting and possibly some good podcast discussion, which we'll get discussion anyway. Whether it will be good, we'll see.
Sounds good.
So this is an afternoon game. I don't think any of these people were particularly great. I mean, they're experienced, but I don't know that any of them were. In fact, I'm pretty confident none of them were professionals per se. Okay. So it was mostly old men. I think it was a five-handed game. Three people, over the age of 60, myself and another like young-looking guy who mentioned having a day job, but knew his I would assume, and maybe this is just stereotyping based on age, but like he seemed like probably the best of the player and like someone who might have played or studied seriously at some point, even though he's not a professional poker player now.
Sure.
This is the game. Like him, he's on my immediate left, and then there's three 60 plus, maybe even 70 plus guys who have probably played a lot of limit hold'em in their lifetimes, but I don't know that they've ever really like studied strategy that seriously.
Sure.
So one generic question. I mean, would you assume? So I'm going to feel pretty comfortable making assumptions about those guys based on their age at a no limit table. That they're going to be pretty nitty. Would you expect that same sort of thing at limit hold'em? That these players are like folding too much, not aggressive enough?
It's a little bit complicated. I think there's a lower rate of, semi-bluff four-betting the turn among those types. One problem is that if they're not aggressive enough, like if he's playing five-handed, if somebody's playing a lot of five-handed 30-60 and is not like aggressive at all, like and is really sort of loose and not loose, but is really like a bit too passive. And I mean, That person's out of poker money by the time he's 70.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, I mean, if you play a lot of limit hold'em, you can't be that nitty.
Yeah, like it's one thing to play no limit. There's a lot of loose money there. Make pretty good reads in big pots. Try not to get too out of line. Just be a little bit. Just sort of not have enough gas in the gas tank or whatever and do okay or even win. Like in limit hold'em, you're drawing stone dead, just stone dead. Like the extra one value bet you get from somebody making a loose call against you is not going to make up for the fact that you're just going to be losing, four big blind pot after four big blind pot that you're not supposed to lose because you get shut out. No bueno.
I very much got the sense that these guys had been playing for, I had not just stumbled across a random 30-60 game that was going for no reason. These were people who played this pretty regularly and had been doing so for a long time.
Yeah. So that's my conjecture.
Okay. So I am in the cutoff with King 9 offsuit, and the younger, probably about my age or even a touch older, but you know, young compared to the rest of the table. The guy he's on my immediate left and has the button, and then two of the older guys are in the blinds. I don't really have much of much of a read on anybody besides what they look like, because I've only been at the table for 10 minutes or so. So I open with K9 offsuit. That seems reasonable.
Yeah, boy, I'm rusty. I think you have to. I think it should be near-ish the bottom of your opening range, but
yeah, I think I'd probably fold King-8.
Yeah, so that's, I think it's an open, but I haven't played Limit Hold'em in a while, so.
I might have even been suited, actually. It doesn't end up becoming a factor in this hand, but.
King-9 suited, I would open, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's not close, but. So anyway, let's just pretend I had King-9 suited and it was a clear open.
Sounds good.
I open with King-9 suited, the button and small blind fold, and then one of the older guys calls from the big blind. Flop is 8-8-4 with rainbow, 8-8-4, no flush draws. He checks, I bet.
Sorry, this is a heads-up pot?
Yes, heads up with the big blind.
Yeah, bet. Auto bet.
It seems like just a, I don't know that, well, I guess like some worse hands can potentially give me action, but it's just one of those like either he gives me action with worse or he folds a lot, and I just have king high, so I don't really see too much downside to betting.
I think you should check 100% and you should bet 100%.
Okay. So I bet and he raises.
Call. Yeah. You got two overs? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I've got two over cards to a pair that he could have, and I mean, this is somewhat, like, given that you're saying I should be betting like 100%, this is even somewhat close to the top of my range. Or not.
Well, you shouldn't have opened all that many hands in the first place.
Yeah, I guess so.
But you got two overs, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You're getting 7.5 to 1. So, and you got position, and good things happen.
Turn is an offsuit deuce, so now 8-8-4 deuce. No flush draws.
Yeah,
he bets again. I call.
I would fold. Yeah, I think he's got it pretty often here. You're not going to bluff him out very much, especially if he's not blasting off with. Like flop was 8-8-4. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, so he should be defending with a lot of his like 7-6s and so on. And if he decides to get bluffy with those, then
that's what I was thinking. Is he can have a lot of gut shots?
Yeah, but given sort of like that's not the kind of leak that's gonna like not doing that is not the kind of leak that's gonna get somebody broke. Yeah, I also don't know. There was a time when a lot of people were flatting everything. We're never three betting in that spot in steal situations out of the big blind. I guess that's the sort of thing that this guy isn't likely to be doing, but I think you're gonna have so much ace high in your range. Granted, he could have some ace high too, so sometimes against
could
some
he?
Range.
See, I really didn't think he would, like, I thought he'd be not exactly polarized, but I didn't expect to see better unpaired hands than mine. I thought he'd be pretty likely to just check all those.
Yeah,
I kind of thought he was going to have either a pair or a gut shot.
I think he can have some ace high sometimes. I mean, if he's super straightforward, then yeah, you've got six outs a lot, and you should call. But if you can have gut shots, like he's allowed to flop three behind sometimes. Like that's
sure. Yeah.
Yeah. If he's really bluffing, like all his gut shots. That he could happily check call with. I mean, that's the other thing is like, this isn't No Limit where, I mean, you know all this already. And people who actually understand Limit Hold'em are probably laughing at us right now because we don't know enough about it. But one thing that's different is that you didn't bet half the pot on the flop where he can't just blissfully check call a gut shot on a paired board out of position and expect not to, be in a tough spot later in the hand. Like you made it one small bet into a 4.5 small bet pot. And that's just not a hard thing to check call with a gut shot. So like he could raise, he could turn on the gas sometimes, but he could also like his pairs are going to be good a lot. He could just say, okay, I have 10 outs. I call. Yeah. It's not a hard thing to do. At least not for me. So that's, and he should raise sometimes. I think I would give it up on the turn. Like, are you calling every hand king high or better on the turn?
Yeah, that's kind of thing. I do feel like each of my individual decisions sort of felt reasonable to me. So, I mean, results, I ended, or I won't reveal his hand yet, but I ended up calling again on the on a blank river. And I was, on the one hand, I feel like at each individual decision point, I'm getting like pretty good odds and think that he is somewhat, you know, polarized with probably having, like, I don't know what his bluffing is going to look like, but I expect his value range is probably not going to be, like, that was maybe the biggest assumption I made based on his age, was just that, like, he wasn't going to be real aggressive for value. But you know, when you frame it that way and you're like, well, you know, considering that you can have every better hand than King Nine as well, like, are you just going down with all of those, and doesn't that result in a really wide call down range? So I'm really just playing devil's advocate. It's not going to take a lot to convince me that I should have folded the turn, because I do think that, you know, the end result here is that I'm calling down really wide.
Yeah, I mean, the best thing to do is to sort of get a great read on him and call when he's bluffing and fold when he's not. But but if you can't do that, I would fold. I would fold here sometimes. One thing that you can consider, like, if you really have a confident read that he has either a pair or a gut shot, is to fold some of your ace highs and call some of your king highs, and then bluff an ace, and get a suspicious call on cards that pair you that are not aces. Like, that's, but that requires a pretty specific read. So there can be some reasons to call with the king high and not with.
And
the
even ace then, high. There's better king highs to call, like, you know, yeah. King 10, king jack are going to be better calling hands than king nine is.
Yeah, but a lot of those you have the full 16 combos of. Yeah, and so that's just, if you're calling with king nine or better, that's 16 combos times a lot of hands,
right.
And he's owning you, and it's not that hard to check call with a gut shot. So I would have folded on the turn. I would not fold no pair all the time. I would be happy to get to showdown sometimes, but not this time. So like, if you had a backdoor flush draw, that helps. But I'm sure you didn't turn a flush draw, because then there would be. Then you'd right. be raising, presumably. So,
So I ended up, you know, calling the river unimproved as well, and he results. Had king eight for trips, which I had a blocker.
Yeah,
a blocker to king eight.
But you did have a pocket to king eight.
He had king eight anyway.
Yeah, boy, that's wow. So, yeah, that's nice hand. I think. Well, nice hand pre-flopping on the flop.
I'll take it. Two for four is about as good as I could probably hope to do in the moment.
How did the game play? Was it like hyper aggressive? Was there?
No, I mean, it was. There a couple of people actually cold called three bets, which was a little surprising to me. Like, you know, I was three betting, which I think at a five handed table is pretty reasonable. You know, like, there were spots where I three bet like ace queen or ace jack from the cutoff, so against an under the gun. Raise.
What else would you ever do? Sorry,
that's what I mean. Yeah, like that, I mean, that it seems reasonable to me. And then, like, there was one hand where the guy on the button cold called a three bet, and one where one of the old guys in the small blind cold called a three bet. I think he ended up also having ace queen. It still seems like it would be better for him to put in the fourth raise there rather than just make it trivial for the original raiser to call with whatever he had.
Yeah, the original raiser is usually going to call two more no matter what. But yeah, if he'd like to have a cold calling range, he might like to cold call his sevens or something like that. And sometimes it can be nice
to have ace queen. Is that a good call with sevens?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I'm very rusty, but like, I think if somebody's opening a lot and then somebody else is three betting a lot, it's hard to fold sevens when you're not going to face any pot size bets ever. So that's, no, I don't know if it's good, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is.
Yeah, I only played in the game for like 20 to 30 minutes, so I can't give you too much of a rundown on it, but it didn't seem like, so I don't think I ever saw a post-flop three bet.
Yeah, that's not surprising. Well, that is surprising. Probably means you weren't making an okay decision playing in the game. How about that?
Yeah, I didn't feel terrible about it. I don't think there was anyone there who was like a limit hold'em expert.
Yeah,
you know, it was more like, I know more about poker than these guys do, and they have more limit hold'em experience than I do. So it's, I still think they're the favorites, but not by a lot.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. So I have another unorthodox hand. So this is like a sort of a thematic strategy segment. hands that the hosts played in games that they aren't usually playing. I'm playing Play Money online for Pride. So there's no money on the line. But this is somebody who's definitely trying. So you can just pretend we're playing for money because, you know, we're not messing around. So this hand is 1,400 to 1,500 play chips deep. It's heads up, no limit. Blinds are 5 and 10. I open for 25 and get called. This person is a pretty aggressive 3-better, maybe a little bit more aggressive than the average player would be this deep. But, yeah, defends somewhere between average and a little bit loose. 3-bets somewhere between average and a little bit loose for this depth. So that's what his call means. The flop comes...
You should tell us your cards.
Oh, yeah. I have 10-8 offsuit. 10 of diamonds, 8 of spades. Flop comes king, queen, 5. Rainbow. Big blind checks. I bet 32 into a pot of 48. And I get called.
So let's start right here with the decision to bet. I'm not sure this is a good flop bet for you.
Okay.
Wow. I don't know. So for one thing, I don't know that this board really favors you. I mean, in some, like at the very top end, it does because he probably doesn't have kings and queens in his range, and you know, maybe also not aces or kings, and you do. But in general, I think. He has a lot of king X and queen X in his flatting range, and he probably doesn't have as many, he probably does have 10-8, but you're going to have some low unpaired drawing dead sorts of hands that he won't have in his range. So I think I think overall he probably flops a little bit more equity here than you do. I also think heads up, there's not a whole lot of range advantage one way or the other. I think you get to do a little bit more triple barreling on this board because at the very top end, you have some advantage. But I think this is basically an any two cards bet that you're making. I mean, your backdoor straight is a little bit relevant, but the fact that you don't have any overcards to a king or a queen makes this pretty close to an any two cards bet. And I feel like you might need a little bit more hand than what you have here. Even if you just have a backdoor flush draw, I think that could be enough. But I think you're just basically betting air in a spot where I don't know that you really should have a profitable any two card C bet.
Yeah, that's useful. I think I would have folded worst tens, and I think this is very near the bottom, and I took myself to have a bad 3-straight. It's a loose bet. I was not betting any two cards as it happens. Whether this is a hand I should put in a betting range that isn't any two cards is a good question, but for this sizing, opening for 25, I'm opening close to 100% in this situation. So there are hands worse than this. And this was a hand I was betting. Not any two cards, but close. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a little bit of a mistake. It's also a little bit, it's not a big C bet, but it's not like I bet a third of the pot. So that's another reason to make it a little bit smaller. So, yeah, it makes sense. Wouldn't be surprised if it's a small mistake. Anything else you want to say before the turn?
No, let's just remind people. So it goes check call for 32 on the flop.
And this opponent, I'm not just saying this to justify future plays. I think this opponent's going to check raise not liberally, but I think this is somebody who maybe puts a few too many draws in a raising range, and especially this deep, has sometimes split his range a little bit much. Here I am telling him this. He listens to the show, but that's okay. So I think he would have check raised some good kings, a lot of hands better than a king, and most I thought sort of in flow he would have check raised most or all of the jack 10. So and 3-bet a lot of the ace jack type hands before the flop. So I think. So that's relevant because, so I have 10-8 offsuit, raise to 25, call, check, call, 32 on the flop. The turn is an ace of clubs. So king of clubs, queen of hearts, 5 of diamonds, ace of clubs on the turn. And
you're holding 10-8 offsuit with no club?
10-8 offsuit, no club. Big blind checks, and I bet 175, which which is a substantial overbet, like 1.6x pot, given the play money rake. So, again, we started 1,400 big blinds deep. My rationale is that I have every combination of Jack 10. I have every combination of aces, kings, and queens, and fives. And I have, yeah, not to mention ace, king, and ace, queen. Whether I would do this with king, queen is more questionable. But I've got a big nutted range. My opponent, I think, does not have nearly as many nut combinations. There's a backdoor flush draw up. I can have a lot of combinations of those clubs. I can bluff those if it comes in, I think. And I want to inflate the pot. I think the top end of my range is now a lot better than his. I think it would be marginal to peel ace high on this flop, at least too many ace highs. So I think this person's in some range trouble, and I would like to punish him for it. And I'd like to be able to bluff. I choose this hand to bluff with. You know, low showdown value. It's got a gut shot. It may be a bit confusing if a jack comes on the river, although I do have all those combinations of Jack 10, and I'd like to win this pot, so I bet a lot. How does that sound?
That seems pretty reasonable to me. I think a fair bit hinges on the assumption that he's going to check raise most of his Jack 10 on the flop, which, you know, I think given what I said about this flop before, that it's kind of one where he has an advantage in the middle. You know, as long as the pot doesn't get too huge, like he's going to have. His range is like thicker with King X and Queen X than yours is, but he doesn't have as many top end type hands on the flop. So I actually don't think this is a real good flop for him to be check raising real aggressively. You know, he doesn't have a lot of hands that want to build huge pots. He has a lot more like bluff catch and or, you know, check call flop value bet river sorts of hands, and not a lot of, you know, let's play for stacks kind of hands. Yeah. And like the let's play for stacks hands that he does have, or that he has the potential of turning, you know, because you have so much incentive to, you know, like because you get to do some additional bluffing, like because of the fact that you have, you know, the kings and queens in your range, the sets that is, like when he does have a you know, real nutted hand like a king queen or pocket fives, he doesn't have as much incentive to fast play those because you should be doing, you know, a fair bit of fast playing yourself on this board anyway. So I think that like his check raising a lot of Jack 10 here is a fairly substantial mistake on his part, but you know, if that's what he's doing, that's what he's doing, and you certainly should be able to take advantage of it. And I think you've identified a lot of reasons why this is a good spot. You know, among other things, against a player who will check call a lot of Jack 10, it's not obvious to me that a hand like a set of aces is a hand that you could overbet here. Yeah. I think that the presence of a lot of Jack 10 in his range would make it difficult for you to overbet sets for value.
Yeah.
But if he doesn't have that, then you end up in the really nice, readers of a book like Mathematics of Poker or Expert Heads Up No Limit should be familiar with the concept of the polarized range versus bluff catcher game. And if you're pretty confident that his range is capped out at, let's say, king queen, or maybe even occasionally ace queen or something, but you know, you think like he's usually fast playing, you know, ace queen preflop and, you know, king queen maybe on the flop or preflop and Jack 10 on the flop, and you think he's like capped out or has like very few hands above a relatively low ceiling, then you get to do a lot of overbetting for value and a lot of overbet bluffing. And I think you're right that this is a hand that fits nicely into the overbet bluffing range, because it does have some equity when called. It blocks the Jack 10, even though we're thinking that, you know, he's check raising that more often than not. I mean, I still think he's going to have some Jack 10 in his check call flop range. And so, like, blocking that is nice for you in addition to the equity that it gives you. And other kinds of blockers are not going to be hands that you would want to overbet. So I think the more likely check call kinds of hands for him are going to be maybe king jack, king 10, queen jack, queen 10, some kind of ace x if he peeled the flop with ace x, which I think, as you said, is a little borderline. But you don't necessarily want to be bluffing. So, I mean, you do have a blocker to king 10 or queen 10. You don't really want to be bluffing when you have an ace or a king or a queen in your hand. Those are hands that you probably would either not bet the flop or not overbet the turn with. So, you know, although there might be some better blockers in terms of hands that that matter more than Jack 10 in terms of, you know, his ability to defend against an overbet, I think that they're not going to be good bluff candidates for you for other reasons. So yeah, I think this is a good spot and a good hand for you to overbet. Or, you know, I think that the threshold for you to overbet as a bluff is relatively low. And I think that, you know, you've identified reasons why your hand is a good candidate for that.
Sweet. So opponent pauses a little bit and calls. So
he also typed WTF.
Yeah. Yeah. That happened, yes. So going into the river, there's like close to 500 in the pot and little over twice that behind. So SPR about 2. And the river is a brick. Let me pull this up here.
4 diamonds.
Yeah, 4 diamonds. And big blind checks, and I give up. The turn brought in a backdoor flush draw. I was planning to bluff the flush card. Possibly bluff on a 10, but not bluffing an offsuit. Nothing. Does that make sense? I gave up.
I don't know about bluffing on a 10. I mean, I guess for the same reasons that you're playing 10-8 this way, you could play Jack 8 or Jack 9 this way as well. I would kind of expect him to have a fair bit of like Jack X and 2-pair combinations when the river is a 10. I mean, if you overbet, the fact that it's 2-pair shouldn't really matter that much, but I think for a lot of people, it might. Like, the fact that they improved to 2-pair on the river might make them more likely to call. But it's probably fine. I definitely think a club is a good river for you to bet, and you should have a lot more club-club combinations than he does. And, you know, giving up, it's sort of like you're going to have a lot of bluffs in your range. You want to continue with some of them. I don't know how much it matters, you know, which ones you choose for that. I think that actually the fact that he typed WTF on the turn and tanked for a while before calling, I think probably for exploitive reasons, you can just bluff blanks less than optimally. I think a lot of people just sort of make a decision on the turn about whether or not, you know, like, it's like if the board texture changes in a meaningful way on the river, then they'll do something different. But a lot of people, especially if you overbet the turn, they're kind of going to make a decision of like, well, I'm always going to call a blank.
Yeah.
I think people who plan on folding blanks often just fold the turn.
Yeah, how do you feel about betting an ace? I think I probably would have.
I mean, I don't think you should be overbetting ace X on the turn. Like, if you just had like ace 9 or something, I don't think I'd recommend overbetting that on the turn. Yeah.
So there's ace king, king's full, queen's full.
Sure. I mean, that's not. I mean, I think an ace is actually kind of bad for you to rep those hands. Like, I mean, ace king is a pretty strong hand even without improving to another ace on the river.
That's right. Especially given the read, it doesn't help.
Yeah. I think that just, you know, he's just gonna be like, LOL, you can have trips. We're playing heads up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. Good thing that card didn't hit. Yeah. Okay. So he had ace 8 offsuit. So I didn't really think he would peel that on the flop. I mean, of course it's possible, but I'm not sure how much ace-x is in his range. So I'm comfortable with the results. I think I get a fair number of folds doing this, but it's an overbetting spot. So there you go. I think I should do more of that generally. I think overbetting is a theoretically important tool that I very rarely use. So I should.
Yeah. And it's a good way to, I mean, as you say, I do think his peel is a little loose on the flop, and it's the kind of thing that's like fine. If he, like you, is someone who hasn't played seriously for a while, you know, like whatever heads up experience he might've had from a few years ago, might've been in an environment where it was a little safer to peel a hand like ace eight on the flop because people didn't barrel quite as well.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those hands where like, yeah, he has the right equity if he could just magically go to showdown once he calls the flop bet.
Yeah.
But it's just a very good board for you to barrel. And there's, you know, he's not generally going to be very, like, even when he hits the ace on the turn, he still has just sort of a marginal bluff catcher when you overbet. And you know, certainly if he hits like an 8 on the turn, he can't, like, there's very few turn cards that are going to be good for him. Yeah. And he's just going to be in a lot of ugly spots later. So I think it probably is, you know, close but not a good flop call, and making sure that you have really good, you know, barreling, including overbetting, strategy for a turn and river is the best way to leverage the fact that he's making a small mistake with that flop peel.
Yeah, I mean, in his defense, one thing that I'm actively trying to correct in a lot of poker formats is one and done itis. So if he thinks I'm a like one and done C-better type where I C-bet too much and double barrel too little, then Ace-8 is fantastic. Like, he just owns me by playing his hand like this. So
that's what I mean. And there was a lot more of that a few years ago. Yeah. Like people making the mistake of one and dunning too often.
Yeah. But like, I still do it. Like, that's a big problem. Like, so he's possibly doing well, sort of range against range, and he won this hand. So nice hand, Mr. Mystery Opponent. So.
And that is... I actually just had a funny like self-realization moment where I was like, you know, some people will just automatically call any blank on the river after they call the turn. And then I was thinking back to my King 9 call down.
It's so easy. I mean, he's betting, how many chips is that? 6 chips on the river?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot more than 6 chips in the pot. Real easy to call. All right. Good. All right. Tapping on my window pane, feeling faint, feeling ashamed, spread too thin and hoping for a sin, no, no, for a word that could take away the pain. Sleepless nights, do I need some kind? The devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.